Welcome to Let's Talk About It, co-hosted by Maria Wyatt and Scott Dudley. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.
Good morning, Imperial Valley. You are listening to your weekly wellness radio, Let's Talk About It, with Scott and Maria. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUVO 88.7 Radio Bilingüe. Our phone number here at the station is 337-8874. And if you want to access this podcast or previous podcast radio shows, you can access it at kxoradio.com.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good.
Cold?
A little bit chilly.
Got chilly this morning. Well, we've got a great show for you. Let's just jump right on in. Again, 337-8874 is the phone number. We're here today with Dr. Heather Wyatt Nickel. We got two Wyatts in the house, which is kind of cool. And she's the professor of public administration in for the University of Baltimore. So she's flown out here at her own. We got her on a phone link. And the subject today is kind. You know, we're the mental health wellness people, and so you're probably going, public administration. Where are we going here? Here's where we're kind of going. You know, I'm starting to notice that we live in kind of an economically challenged area. I don't know.
You think so?
I've been here 25 years, and I guess that 30% unemployment rate over time, and poverty, and the high dropout rates, and teen pregnancies, and lack of people going to college, and
actually, we had a lot of kids going into college according to the recent information.
We're up to like 7, right?
No, 80% go to college. Most of them probably to IBC.
Which then graduates all those kids, right? And they get higher level.
I don't know about that. I would go ahead.
Anyway, so I think by any standards, we are the most challenged economic county in California.
Yes.
And
we're the poorest.
And the question is what does that really look like? And so to get that, I think we go to a doctor of public administration and somebody who's done some research on that, and we start to talk about what does the landscape look like, and is that, and ultimately make our own decisions about whether that affects our wellness, whether that's something that really burdens us, and then whether or not that's something that we need to deal with on a larger scale. So good morning, Dr. Wyatt Nickel.
Good morning.
I heard you back there.
I like the Wyatt.
thank you.
She's a Wyatt by birth. I'm Wyatt by marriage. So.
Yes. And I'm Scott, and she's Maria. So good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, it's interesting because when I first talked to you about kind of lining up the show, the American dream was still intact somehow, or at least in theory it was. And since we've talked about 6 weeks ago, the whole Occupy America, Occupy Wall Street, and Occupy most other major cities.
San Diego,
cities.
Oakland, everywhere.
Oakland had a party last night.
Oh, yes, I saw that.
Here in the Valley, I think they're doing one here, too.
Yes, we have an Occupy El Centro faction that meets in the parks on the weekends and walks in front of Bank of America. And anyway, it's really kind of beginning to take even the political discourse by storm. There's some foundation for that in your research, isn't there, Doctor?
Yes. I'm really excited, actually, about the Occupy Wall Street movement. We have an Occupy Baltimore here as well. And from what I understand, today there's going to be Occupy the Treasury.
Wow.
In Washington. And I was in New York on Friday. I did not get a chance to visit Occupy Wall Street in New York. I was in and out so quickly. But it's exciting to see that people are finally challenging some of the problems that we're having with economic inequality. And you all are certainly on target. I have, in my research, I've write about social class because it's near and dear to my heart for a variety of reasons. I was a first-generation college student, come from working-class background, and I try to write on issues of social class from a variety of perspectives. But as it pertains to health and public administration in general, there are several studies that have shown that neighborhoods that are poverty-stricken have residents that are more likely to have health problems, delinquency and academic problems among school-age youth. And it really does carry over into opportunities for people living in such neighborhoods. I'll give you an example of Baltimore City and Baltimore, some of the surrounding counties. What's interesting here Baltimore City is one of the poorest cities in the nation, right? One of the 10 poorest cities in the nation.
And they even got their own HBO series because they're so poor, right?
Yes, yes. We like not to talk about that. Yes. Some officials are upset about David Simon's movie, but he does provide, in my opinion, a very good portrayal of many of the neighborhoods here in Baltimore. And if we look, for example, at median household income in Baltimore City, and this is data from 2007, so it's a little bit dated, but it was $36,304. Now, some of our surrounding counties, interestingly, are some of the wealthiest counties in the nation. Howard County, the median household income was $97,837. And if we look at the number of kids living in poverty, ages 5 to 17 in Baltimore City, that was 26%. In Howard County, that was 4%.
So we have a kind of a disparity, and there's some impacts for the people who are on the lower end of that disparity. You know, is it one of those things where, I don't know, I kind of in my imagination see, you know, 30 kids showing up in the morning, the first day of school in kindergarten, and see 30 potential CEOs, 30 potential Harvard graduates, 30 potential presidents walking in the door. Is that and that's my kind of my conception, I guess, of the American dream, is if you come and you do what you have to do and you turn it all in on time. And
well,
and
that's not just yours. It's also the world. They see the United States, too, as the opportunity. Look at all the illegal, you know, the immigration, legal and illegal. They're trying to come here.
Right, and one of my papers focused on the American dream as a myth, and I approach it from three different perspectives. One, I look at mobility, and then I ask the question, how do we come to believe that if we work hard enough, we're going to move up that economic ladder and attend Harvard or become the next CEO? And then I also look at how the American dream has been recast and reconceptualized to try to provide some sort of hope. But looking at economic mobility, for example. Let me provide a few stats for you. One, a comparison of men between the ages of 25 and 35 in 1974 to men between the ages of 25 and 34 in 1994 found median income in 1974 for those men was $30,000 in 1994 dollars compared to $23,000 in 1994 dollars. So we start to see a loss of income for that generation. Also, if we look at children that are born into parents at the bottom of the income distribution, only 6% rise to the top of the income distribution. It becomes more disheartening, though, when we look at higher education and the disparities in the school system. K through 12 certainly reach over into higher education. For example, 75% of Harvard's freshman class in 1999 were from families of the top income earners. Only 3% of freshmen of 146 top universities represent families at the bottom. 3%.
It's kind of sounding more like from India. You know, you're born
system.
Caste system. You're born in the bottom, you'll stay in the bottom. There's no hope for you. Okay. Oh, that's so depressing. But you know, that's continued. You know, my family, my mom's side of the family, they're from Mexico, and they sometimes see me as, gosh, you're so lucky living in the United States. And I go, no, I break it down. You know, no, we get taxed so much. You know, from my paycheck, this is all I get back. Everything goes to, you know, my insurance, my retirement, so, you know, just federal taxes, state taxes. I still have to pay state taxes. I still have to pay, after all that, more federal taxes. And then you get sales tax, and then you get property tax, and then you get unsecured tax, and then just fuel tax, and, you know, just everything. And they're just amazed at how much we are being taxed and how much little we take home.
Well, the middle class certainly carry that burden of taxation, and we know that's a touchy subject right now in Congress as well,
yes.
As far as the tax breaks for the wealthy. But it is true, the middle class are the ones that carry the burden with the tax rates.
Now, from a public administration standpoint, there's certainly a push right now for austerity. We need to spend back our deficit. We're going to belong to other countries. And a lot of that discussion has taken place on very, very basic, quote-unquote, entitlement you might call it, safety net programs. What, as a public administration specialist, what do you see as the long-term discussion or the long-term impacts of that kind of an austerity focus?
Well, I think that in many ways, one thing that's happened is our whole discourse has changed about controlling the budget deficit. Right? One thing to keep in mind is we did not have a budget deficit in 2000. In fact, the president, President Bush at that time, inherited a surplus.
Yes, right? He did.
So it's not as if this has been something going on for generations. And it's important to keep that in mind. What has certainly got us into this deficit are a couple of things, tax cuts for the wealthy being one. Deregulation is another,
oh, yeah.
And it contributed greatly to the Great Recession. And if we look at the cost of war, whether you support or oppose, wars do cost money, and that's certainly increased our deficit. So I think in many ways they're trying to change the whole image of what's gone on over the past 11 years.
Is there a footprint on the lower economic classes, including the rapidly shrinking pocketbooks of the middle class, that you can measure in kind of a public policy way? And what happens to people who are on the tail end of this, who are on the less empowered political side of the spectrum, perhaps?
Well, they certainly lose out in many ways. If we look at poverty rates, right, from 1959 to 2010, looking at census data, white poverty rate is 9.9%, Asian at 12.1%, Hispanic at 26.6%, and African American at 27.4%. Also, if we look at the change in real family income, right, and this is where we get into the 99 percenters in many ways, those at the bottom 20% have lost income, right, by 7.4%. Right? Those making less than $26,000 have lost income. Those at the top 5% earning $200,000 and up are increasing their income by 72.7%. And it really is disheartening. So we see a loss of income at lower levels, and, of course, increase in income at the higher levels at the expense of the lower levels when we look at the quintiles. But in addition to that, from a public administration standpoint, it makes all the difference because services are provided through revenue bases, and we need a constant flow of revenue in the form of property taxes, for example, and that becomes a burden in many cases on communities that are trying to provide basic services like fire and police protection. Our city is now experiencing another budget deficit this year as a result of the economic downturn, as a result of loss of population, and as a result of more people being unemployed and unable to contribute to the revenue base.
Maybe the writers of our, we have a proposition that was passed here, Prop 63, and that's the Mental Health Services Act, and that is being funded solely by millionaire tax. Anybody who earns $1 million or more gets taxed, and that's how our services are being funded. So, saying that, you know, the people that are earning $200,000 and more is growing, well, that's good for us.
It's good for that one element of mental health funding.
Yes,
however,
yes, that's very.
However, parenthetically, your doors will be filled with people who,
yes,
the stress of poverty.
More. The bottom part, that 99%, is growing. It's so much more bigger.
So what I hear you saying, Dr. White-Nickel, is that upward mobility is really very limited. You mentioned only 6% go from moving on up.
Right.
And but standing pat, you know, I guess, you know, we upward mobility was an assumption until my generation, frankly, and I think I'm right on the edge of not achieving it. But standing pat has eroded since the 1970s. That's what I hear you saying.
Right, right. And, of course, we've seen a shift from the manufacturing base of the economy to a service economy, and then we also see outsourcing of the service economy, and that has become problematic as well. When we look at economic inequality, in many ways, it comes down to the jobs that are available. And there have been conflicting studies in that area. For example, we often hear that there are jobs out there. However, many people in the American labor market do not have the skills. Some argue that's not true. Laffer, not Reagan's economist, but another Laffer, L-A-F-F-E-R, wrote a book several years ago called The Job Skills Mismatch and Job Training Charade. And in that, he talks about the fact that people such as those working in Silicon Valley out in your neck of the woods, right, started to also see their jobs being outsourced. So it wasn't a matter of job skills mismatch. It was a matter of jobs being relocated.
So almost a globalization problem where if you can find a place to have labor provided more inexpensively,
very much so, mm-hmm,
then international corporations would go to that place.
Right.
Well, and we're a good example. We're right here on the border, and you see so much more manufacturing in Mexicali Valley, which is, 12, 15 miles away, because all the American companies, or the companies are moving over there to the maquiladoras and hiring this cheap, very, very cheap labor. And right here in our county, we're suffering. We're the poorest county in California, and one of the poorest in the country, too. And over there in Mexicali, it's growing. That city keeps on growing and growing and growing.
Right. And I wouldn't suggest that we close our borders or, restrict trade completely. But we do need to hold organizations, corporations specifically, accountable when they take jobs out of the U.S., right?
No, we live next to a very interesting irony where they've opened the borders to trade. However, for us that have to transverse borders every day, the security and the individual scrutiny that people go through.
Oh, don't even go there. God. You're gonna start me. They put people in cages. Okay.
Uh-oh.
When they want to search your car, like random secondary inspection, they put a new cage, and it's like a dog cage. And
oh,
they
wow.
put you there, and which, I'm going to refuse.
So
I might get arrested.
The plastic stuff crosses the border very easily now.
Yeah, exactly. But the human.
The flesh and blood, not
for
so.
Us, like me, us American citizens, we get put in cages.
Heather, we're right at the top of the hour. Let's go ahead and take a short break. And,
okay.
And when we'll come back, let's talk about maybe how we could do something compassionate and sustainable and what public policy might look like in a way that kind of begins to maybe benefit the 99%.
Okay.
All right, this is Let's Talk About It. We'll be right back after this break.
You're listening to Let's Talk About It, presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services. A 5 to 6 minute highlight podcast of the same show is available on KXORadio.com.
Welcome back. You are still listening to your weekly wellness radio, Let's Talk About It, with Scott and Maria. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingue. Our phone number here at the station is 337-8874.
You are dialed in. And if you enjoy the show today or want to share it with somebody or didn't catch the first part, you can always go back and check the podcast on KXORadio.com.
Yes.
We're here today with Dr. Heather Wyatt-Nickel, and she's a professor at the University of Baltimore, Public Administration. Dr. Wyatt-Nickel. And now I get two Wyatts. So it's
I know. They're asking me, are you related? And I go, no.
every third person, we're a rural community here, and every third person is actually named Wyatt, so.
No. My husband's family came from Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
They're from Oklahoma, so. We have a lot of from Oklahoma here.
Yeah, one of the things about living in a valley where the summer temperatures are 120 is everybody pretty much had to come from somewhere else, whether it was within the nation's borders or without the nation's
like
borders.
Like you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm from Michigan.
So, well, picking up on the border, I'll just make some comments from where we left off. One sad event when we look at economic downturn in the U.S. is there tends to be a scapegoating against immigrants in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think one solution, and I'm know that I'm not supported very much in this, would be actually to open our borders, right? Open our borders to immigration, allow people to come over without being put in the cages, particularly, as you're referring to. And I often I lived in Texas for a while, so I often reminded students that Texas used to be Mexico, right? So somehow we forget our history. Right? We forget our history, and it tends to repeat itself.
It's and you know, I talk to several people, and sometimes they're very they blame, and it's true, they blame the illegals for our economic woes. But bottom line is that us Americans, we don't want to do the work that the illegals do. You know, we don't want to clean the toilets. We don't want to clean the dishes. We don't want to go in, you know, extreme weather conditions, freezing cold, picking crops, bending down, being, you know, carrying stuff, labor intensive jobs. We don't want to do that.
Right.
And then we complain that about the illegals because they're the only ones that want to do the job. You know, my husband refuses to, I mean, I'm not saying we're hiring illegals, but he doesn't want to clean the pool. He doesn't want to cut the grass. So I don't want to clean the house. So we hire people. But, you know, they're not illegals, of course, but those are the jobs that we don't want to do.
Right. And Maryland, it's crab picking. And, of course, we do have farms out here. Right?
Yes. And so, you know,
did someone ever get those Georgia peaches? They were having a big deal because I think they passed some laws about making sure people had proper documentation, and didn't it just crash their whole agriculture?
I'm not sure, but I remember just a few days ago they had another issue about apples, right? And the problems of apples.
Oops, there's another crop, huh?
No, but it's you know, and again, that's true. The illegals get blamed a lot, but you know, my parents were migrant workers, and my dad was a truck driver, and he sometimes made us go out in the fields and pick tomatoes. And when I went and picked tomatoes on Saturday morning, I knew I didn't want to do this for the rest of my life. So I said, you know what, I'm going to go to school.
No, I'm sorry, but your research, you said that opening the borders based on what you've learned as a researcher would be a wise idea. What do you anticipate would happen?
One, I believe that if you do open up borders and you allow open flow of labor back and forth, right? Right here we're with the NAFTA, so Canada and Mexico. One thing that we can do is eliminate some of the marginalization that immigrants face. For example, when I lived in Texas, we had a large immigrant population within the town that I was living in. Legal or illegal, I'm not sure. However, because of the fact that they were scared of being deported, right, individuals that may have been illegal or in some cases legal, were fearful of reporting substandard housing, right? You had people living in trailers that may have had holes in the roofs and holes in the floors, right? They're scared to report that. They're scared to report if they've been victimized, for example, if someone's been robbed, or they don't want to report that either. So I think if you open up borders, you eliminate that, what we might call marginalization, right, of individuals. And the employers themselves are taking advantage of immigrants as well, right? So
kind of like we had the Bracero program. Back in the...
Yes, it used to be that people could come over with certain kind of registration and work. And temporarily, et cetera, et cetera.
And then go back to Mexico.
So what, right. But what I hear you saying then is the lowness of the bar through the hazards of migration and through the legal stuff and through the marginalization and splitting. I mean, because ultimately, if you can blame somebody else, then you create... you know, splitting that helps the current status quo remain, helps to lower the bar for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So if substandard housing somewhere is okay for someone, then very, very low standard housing is normed or even better.
Right.
You know, it's looked at, well, at least I've got, you know, I may not have any heat, but I don't have any holes in my floor, so I'm okay. Is the splitting phenomena, like for immigrants versus non-immigrants, et cetera, is that deliberate policy by people who have economic control, or is that something that just is natural or happens?
I'll start from a broader perspective there. I don't think that there is any major conspiracy among the elite in the United States. However, what we end up with, the whole idea and the myth of the American dream is embedded in our culture, and it's perpetuated. It's perpetuated often through institutional isomorphism, and this is by DiMaggio and Powell. And how does that happen? It happens in three ways. One is coercive isomorphism. So you might have PACs lobbying Wall Street, or excuse me, PACs, Wall Street lobbying Congress. And you might have normative isomorphism, right? And in addition to that, we have mimetic isomorphism. Normative isomorphism, I think in many ways, is stronger yet subtle. And here's how. People are trained in various professions, right?
Right.
And they start to view the world through the lens of their profession. Mm-hmm. And we see that as part of, for example, Obama's economic team, right? Treasury Secretaries Larry Summers and Robert Rubin, right? Both had positions at Goldman Sachs, right? they were both influential in dismantling the Glass-Steagall Act. Summers was also influential in preventing regulation of derivatives, right? Rubin later became director of Citigroup, right? He advocated deregulation and then was a recipient of the bank bailout funds. So in many ways, what we have is a standardized way of thinking that marginalizes issues of social class. And that standardized way of thinking is found in our professional schools, our business schools, and then get into the subdisciplines of economics, finance, and so forth. So I don't think there's a great conspiracy out there, but it tends to occur through isomorphism.
So on one hand, you've got the people who have, using their have as political leverage.
Right.
On the other hand, you've got a natural kind of perspective where if you're working in the banking industry, you're trained and promoted and successful based on your ability to support the banking industry.
Right.
And then supporting the banking industry naturally means that you're going to be able to create the political landscape in which the banking industry can thrive.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. And in 2004, there were 1,600 corporate PACs in D.C. Financial institutions lobbied hard, right, from 1998 to 2008.
Aren't they the leading contributors to both political parties' campaign systems?
Yes, and that's that's what becomes a little disheartening, right? If you look at both parties, whether it's Democrat or Republican, they are recipients of those PACs, certainly so.
So they are well connected to the political system on both sides.
Right, and many of it starts again. Much of it starts within our professional training. Right, if we look at public administration is a great example. If we look at public administration, social class is not really addressed. Right. Oldfield, Ken Oldfield is a good friend of mine, and I ran across one of his articles many years ago on social class. And one thing that he found that there were only 5 articles on social class published in the 1960s in our premier journal, which is Public Administration Review.
Weren't the 60s like the turbulent
yeah.
times of self-examination and change?
Right, and well, that number is up there, right?
5.
By the time we got to the 1980s, there was only 1 article published on social class in the 1980s and 2 articles in the 1990s, right? So if you look at textbooks as well, if you go back to just the K-12, the whole idea of income inequality, right, is really marginalized as well. High school textbooks look at social class as non-existent,
yeah.
and America is portrayed as 390 years of progress, right?
Yes.
So something as broad and as focused on public, hello, it's half of your name, somehow overlooks class distinctions that ultimately really do have a very significant. I mean, when we were talking about getting this show together, I was thinking, you know, there isn't really a lot of discussion about how poverty might impact depression, and I was thinking it's almost the same as like the people not studying the fact that people with the flu don't go out and exercise very much. Because
right.
it's such an obvious connection that it's almost overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you're saying that same thing is true even in the whole field of public administration.
Yes.
Where do we go from there, yeah. I guess?
Well,
how do we change the discourse?
I know.
One thing, in the paper that I wrote on marginalization of social class, hope. Right? I'm not a cynical person. I always like to have hope. And that might seem a little strange, but if we look at the 2008 Democratic National Convention, the American Dream was cited by every speaker, every top speaker. Hillary Clinton, right? Hillary Clinton, in her speech, provided information about the increased cost of living and job losses four different times. Bill Clinton, the very next night, right, talked about the American Dream four different times and used inequality three times throughout his speech. Now, here is where hope comes in. When Barack Obama took center stage at the Democratic National Convention, he changed the language of the American Dream into one of the American Promise, right? And he mentioned the word promise 24 times throughout his speech that evening. And I'll give you a quote of what he said. In Washington, they call this the ownership society, but what it really means is you're on your own. Out of work, tough luck. No health care, the market will fix it. Born into poverty, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, even if you don't have boots. Right? Mm. And he really notes the importance of the American Dream being one of an American promise and shifts it from individual responsibility to collective responsibility. I mean, we can go into the scripture.
And that really resonated, didn't it?
Right? Into scripture of I am my brother's keeper or I am my sister's keeper. Mm-hmm. Right? That we do have a responsibility to one another.
Well, and that message resonated with youth who are, you know, facing the mountains of student loan debt.
Yes, and unemployment. And
marginalized employed people. And so everybody is kind of at some level agreeing that that's the landscape and that's the way it has to look. How do we end up breaking through the established powers that be, I suppose, and getting that into some sort of legislative format?
We have to start from the ground up, right? We have to address issues of social class within our education system. We have to raise awareness, and I think Occupy Wall Street's doing a wonderful example of that. Right? they have brought it to the forefront where we are no longer silent about the issue of inequality. Because for many years, we would always use the example in a political science department that I used to work for, is you would have an individual voting against his or her own interest, right, in the name of a particular party, right? So Americans supported tax cuts for the wealthy, even though they didn't benefit. In fact, they were hurt by
yes.
tax cuts for the wealthy, right? But 71% of Americans tended to support that because in their minds, one day they might move up the economic ladder, right? But they're also taught at a very early age that this challenge to business is a challenge to American democracy in general, right? So I think we have to change our way of thinking and the way we represent equality in the U.S., especially when we talk about economic inequality. And that has to start in the elementary schools, and we certainly have to address it in higher education. Recently published an article on integrating issues of social class into MPA core curriculum and talked about how we might address government investment, right? Going back to FDR.
So beginning to bring social justice issues and sustainability, almost like the greening of the energy movement, almost having like a greening in a people sense of the public administration movement.
Right.
You know, what do we do for sustainability? What do we do to create living wages globally? And what does that end up looking like in ostensibly the richest country on the face of the earth?
Right. And, you know, yesterday the Human Development Index came out. I'm not sure if you all saw this or not. Yes, America was listed as number 4. However, once you account for income inequality, America dropped to...
What is it, 29 or something?
23. Yes.
Isn't our income disparity now approaching that of the Philippines and Mexico?
So, I think, one, we have to... shed this myth, right, that America is somehow the great land of opportunity. I don't want to say that opportunity is not available. Right? Opportunity is available, but people become really dissatisfied when they work their entire life, they pursue a higher education, they take on mountains of student loan debt, and then they graduate and they're unable to find a job in their field.
And that's what's happening right now. It's just we've told kids, you know, go to school, go to college, and you're going to, you know, get a good job and you know, not, you know, improve what, you know, if your parents were, like, for example, here, immigrants or work in the fields, you go to school and you're going to get a job and, you know, you can get the American dream.
And
guess what?
Get a vehicle that rides on $200 tires and holds $150 worth of gas.
Right.
But right now, you know, kids are coming out of college and they don't have, there's no jobs.
Yes, it's very disheartening. And the unemployment rate among young people is extremely high, right? Double that of the 9% average of unemployment.
I was reading a study coming from Britain, a sociology study, that indicated that because Britain has for this long time had this kind of underclass of social service recipient people who are just kind of trapped. Because there really aren't economic opportunities, and it's the dole, I suppose it's called. And what they've seen is that that group of people has developed a different evolutionary tract of human lifestyle patterns. They're having children at a younger age. They're engaging in different types of higher risk behaviors that would ensure they're kind of living fast and hard and quick. So their lifestyle has approached, you know, it's going to be, you know, I'm going to be poor and suffer, so I'm going to have my fun while I'm young, and I'm going to do as much, you know, pleasure seeking as I can, understanding that I'll probably die in my early 50s.
Yes.
Amazing.
And this also plays out in David Simon's book, The Corner. Bringing up The Wire again, he also has a wonderful book, The Corner, which part of The Wire and part of The Corner film releases are reflected in the book itself. And he brings up that very point. The youth in Baltimore City that are living in really severe circumstances do tend to have children fairly early because... Yeah, the chances of survival are not that great. We have the highest per capita homicide when you look at the population rate compared to the murder rate. Detroit and Baltimore are usually one or the other.
Neck and neck. That's right.
Yes.
That's your home. That's your home state.
That's my home state. I saw my first stabbing in Detroit as a 10-year-old driving through with my dad lived in Detroit for a while. I remember, I remember not only the stabbing. I remember the relative lack of anybody really caring. You know, it didn't stop traffic. Yeah. It was really, you know, everybody just kind of kept going.
Right. People become desensitized.
It sounds like we've got some real growing pains in front of us. If we're going from a public administration standpoint, from a public policy standpoint, if we're going to somehow take collective responsibility for making a society that is less stressful, perhaps more, again, sustainable is the word that pops into my head.
Right. One area that I've moved into, and I haven't really refined that area yet, builds on Elaine Reisner's notion of a caring economy, right? And when we look at this idea of a caring economy, one thing that she argues is if we look at capitalist systems and communist systems, neither one of them, right, are good for individuals, right?
Right.
And so we start to move into this idea of care values, and care looking at social connectedness, difference and equality, children should be the starting point for economic paradigm, right, rather than domination. So how we move into this is a little more difficult. It seems that one of the perennial arguments in the U.S. is, what is the proper role of government? Right? Obama made a nice inaugural speech in which he said, those are tired old arguments, but they're not going away. Right? They're not going away.
Power tends to want to keep power.
Yes, yes.
And a caring society or a caring system of economy would necessarily have to share power.
But, you know, going like this whole healthcare reform, healthcare, is just, you know, you have people know that, you know, sometimes there's a lot of people that are uninsured.
Right.
And a lot of people losing their homes because of medical issues and problems and, you know, it just... But then when you want to try, the government wants to try to, you know, help the people, you know, the people themselves go, no, that's socialist. You know, we're going to a... we're Americans. We don't do that.
Right.
Okay.
And then, yeah, that's always funny. You know, someone arguing against health care. Don't cut my Medicare. You know?
Don't cut it. But, you know, hey, don't do that either because that's a socialist. You know, just... So, you know, there's so much conflict with among us, and I don't know, it's going to be hard.
Yeah, in a place that honors the individual and really emphasizes the power of the individual, we may at some point have to go back and emphasize the community and emphasize the power of supportive community.
Yes, very much so, and I think that's our biggest problem, being in an individualist culture that we are, the perception that if you fail, it's your fault. Not necessarily so, and if we look at the studies of economic mobility and we look at the poverty rates in inner cities and rural areas, and we look at the parents, the wealth into which you're born or not born, right, as a major factor in determining your status later on in life, we understand that it's not the individual's fault, and that we do have a duty to try to come up with creative solutions. We've had a proliferation of nonprofit organizations in recent years trying to address social concerns. Part of that is a reaction to the fact that we had a devolution in government, right? And government started downsizing and under many administrations, including the Clinton administration. Right? So we're shifting that responsibility from government to the nonprofit sector, but we need to keep in mind that government is us.
Okay? For the people, by the people, or something, huh?
Should be.
Yes, and that's why I refuse to go be put in a jail, in a cage.
I don't blame you. I wouldn't want to be in a cage.
No.
You know, I think, in the context of a 50-minute radio show, that it's clear that there aren't really any easy answers or just kind of drop-down soundbite solutions to this. This is really kind of a fairly complex thing. But I think in some context, it starts with food for thought.
Mm-hmm.
And from my perspective, I think that's where we started today. And I appreciate you coming aboard today, Heather, and if people are interested, is there a place where they can continue this discussion or continue to learn more about the role that economy and society plays on who they are?
There are a variety of different venues right now. The Economic Policy Institute releases several reports throughout the year. The Pew Research Center also has some great reports on income inequality. A panel study of income dynamics is very useful in looking at mobility over time. People can also contact me if you want to share my email. That would be fine, too. Those are just a few venues. The Urban Institute is another. And I'm not familiar with everything out in California at this point.
We are our own banana republic. We are.
But I'm sure that there are some great research institutes out there, given the universities that are out there, right, that are involved in this as well. So.
So stepping out and learning more and gives us at least the foundation to begin to suggest building.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming aboard
today.
I really
appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
We enjoyed it.
And, again, if you've heard the show today or are interested in more, we will have this up on podcast in, say, a week or so.
KXORadio.com.
Wonderful.
Encourage you to go listen to it there. Thank you again, Heather.
Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
And thank you all for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye, you too.
You've been listening to Let's Talk About It, heard each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM, Radio Bilingue. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.